It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
There is almost nothing left here in Paradise. The mayor says she thinks 90% of the homes and buildings in her city are gone. 29 dead here in this fire. More than 50,000 people remain evacuated. The numbers are mind-boggling, and so is the loss. The most destructive wildfire in California's history, now on track to be the state's deadliest. Apocalyptic scenes like these are from the campfire as crews search the smoking ruins in Paradise, California, finding more bodies with more than 200 still reported missing.
We had a engine crew discover a body.
Two of my friends right now are missing, one from Magalia, one out of Paradise. And I'm hoping it ain't one of the body counts.
From the ground and the air, 8,000 firefighters are battling three large fires in both northern and southern California as it burns across more than 300 square miles, an area larger than the city of San Diego. The fires have destroyed some 7,000 homes and businesses. The flames are tearing through areas that haven't seen rain in months. Outgoing Governor Jerry Brown blaming it on climate change.
This is not the new normal. This is the new abnormal. And this new abnormal will continue, certainly in the next 10 to 15 to 20 years.
Meanwhile, a presidential tweet started its own political fire over the weekend as President Trump blamed the blazes on forest mismanagement and threatened to take away federal money. The presidents of two professional firefighters associations shot back, calling Trump's assertion reckless, ill-informed, and demeaning. On Sunday, the Golden State's governor also weighed in.
Managing all the forests in every way we can does not stop climate change. And those who deny that are definitely contributing to the tragedies that we're now witnessing and will continue to witness in the coming years.
Sandy Rios with you. That's a tragedy happening in California. Many of you have relatives and friends. My father's family, many of them are from California. And so we have connections to that state, and it makes us very sad. That's just an unbelievable disaster that continues to happen. How many forest fires are they going to have this year? It's just amazing. And it's spreading into southern and northern California. So we'll continue to watch that. And, of course, close on the heels of that is the politicization of another tragedy. Whether it's a shooting or whatever, we have to politicize everything. So Governor Jerry Brown rushes up to the mic and he says, it's climate change. It is climate change. And all of you who deny that there's climate change, it's your fault that these people are being burned to death in California because you don't believe in climate change, man-made climate change. And I just want to point out that the Pope, quickly, was speaking at an event yesterday, and the chief threats to the world are climate change and nuclear war. So you see that the left is on the same page. And why is this so egregious, especially by Jerry Brown? It's egregious because the problem in California, as best I can understand it, has come from Jerry Brown's policies, the left's policies of not managing their forests properly. And if you think I'm the only one saying that, the Los Angeles Times, for heaven's sake, wrote an entire editorial just recently saying, adopting more active forest management policies such as increased thinning of trees and conducting controlled burns will help mitigate damage from future wildfires. And then they say fire is not necessarily bad for forests. California used to burn with regularity, and low-intensity fires are vital in some ecosystems to clear excess brush and small trees from the landscape. But there's been a change in fire behavior over the last century as the state and federal government began dousing the blazes. Decades of fire suppression have allowed forests to grow dense with trees. It is the environmental movement that has caused this. It is not climate change deniers. And yet you can see a window into where this is all going. This is what the left does. And just remember, when this happens, remember to understand. You know, I think of the biography of Mao Zedong that I read a number of years ago. When he went to Western Europe to study with the communists on how to take over his own country. And they taught him very carefully to use disasters and blame it. Take the disaster and blame it on your enemies. Adolf Hitler did the very same thing when he burned down the Reichstag. That was the big government building in Berlin. And he blamed it on his enemies at the time, which were the communists, which is an old communist ploy. And Hitler turned it around on them. And so, we've seen this in our culture where there are shootings. I remember the shooting of Gabby Gifford, and they blamed it on Sarah Palin. This is the way it goes. This is the way the left operates. And so it's going to be, this is how they're going to come after good people, is they're going to blame them. I mean, the good people who don't believe in climate change are responsible, after all, for your deaths, for your family losing their homes. So how do you think you're going to respond if you hear that kind of propaganda? It's not going to be good. And that's where we're going to go if the left takes power. And we're watching them take power state after state. It's kind of an amazing thing to watch. As a matter of fact, let's go down to Georgia. Steve Harrigan. Well, it depends on where you are if it's down to Georgia, doesn't it? But Steve Harrigan did an update on the Stacey Abrams, Secretary of State. I'll think of it in a second. Their race for governor. Let's listen.
The fight is still going on here in Georgia, but the tone is getting sharp indeed. Brian Kemp, the Republicans team, is saying Abrams' failure to concede is, quote, a disgrace to democracy. As for the Abrams side, they have launched a number of lawsuits, including one which will delay certification by the counties in Georgia at least one day, and to force those counties to accept provisional ballots which were rejected for what they say are arbitrary reasons. As it stands now, Kemp has about a 59,000 vote lead. He's got 50.3% of the vote. If that were to dip below 50%, that would mean a runoff vote on December 4th. Now, really, how many votes are still out there uncounted? It depends which side you believe. The Kemp side says 17,000, mathematically impossible for the Democrat to win. But the Abrams side said there could be as many as 30,000 votes still out there. We could get some actual results tomorrow. By 5 p.m., that's when all the Georgia counties are scheduled to certify their votes, unless a lawsuit gets in the way.
Well, so an update on that little bit. Judge Amy Totenberg has ruled in favor of Stacey Abrams, saying that now she has till Friday. They're going to check all those provisional ballots. Judge Amy Totenberg, an Obama appointee. Totenberg ruled that Georgia must not certify the election results before Friday at 5 p.m. And a total of 21,190 provisional ballots were cast in the state during the midterm. And as I understand it, that's when you go and you vote in a polling place and your name's not on the list, you're in the wrong place, you're not listed as a registered voter, whatever, but you claim that you are, and so they give you a provisional ballot and that they have to follow up, and some of these are legitimate. You know, if you were a registered voter and they had some mix-up with your polling place, you'd want to be able to vote like this. But it looks as though it might just be used in the wrong way, you think, maybe? All right, so the lawsuit said that of the 1,556 provisional ballots Fulton County reported, they rejected, nearly 1,000 were disqualified because they were cast by voters whose registration records showed them registered in another county. So anyway, they keep saying, you know, every vote counts. But of course, the left doesn't mean what people, that phrase seems to indicate, that they just want everyone to have their say. It's only fair. Everyone should have their say. That's really not what they mean. They mean that every vote can be counted more than once, twice, however many votes they have to find. You know, there have been reports in Florida of them finding whole boxes of votes, and one in a school, one in a cab. It's just amazing. And then in Arizona, Kristen Sinema now has declared victory over Martha McSally, even though Martha McSally was the victor on the election night, Tuesday night. So I don't know what the story is there in terms of the process as well as evenly, but all we know is every time there's a contested race, who prevails? when they go into a recount and they go into the courts, who wins always without fail? It's always the Democrat. And so it makes people wonder. It makes them suspicious. So then that takes us to Florida, of course. And there was a local report in Florida that I thought explained it better than anything. Let's listen.
Even if it takes you into the middle of next week, you better count every vote. We're not going to be shushed. We're not going to be sat down. We are not going to be ignored.
While others appealed to the courts.
Senator Nelson is clearly trying to commit fraud to try to win this election. That's all this is.
Governor Rick Scott filing 3 lawsuits against election supervisors here in South Florida, demanding to know what went wrong when it came to counting ballots in Broward and Palm Beach counties. That first suit alleging Supervisor of Elections Brenda Snipes counted a certain number of ballots after the noon deadline on Saturday.
I've asked the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to go in and do an investigation to find out what happened here. But we clearly know, the judges have already said, they clearly violated the law.
The other 2 lawsuits are requesting the impoundment of voting tabulation equipment from both Broward and Palm Beach counties after the machine recount is completed. In the meantime, Senator Bill Nelson responding with the following statement. If Rick Scott wanted to make sure every legal ballot is counted, he would not be suing to try and stop voters from having their legal ballot counted as intended. He is doing this for the same reason he's been making false and panic claims about voter fraud. He's worried that when all the votes are counted, he'll lose the election. In the governor's race, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum here in South Florida today at the new Mount Olive Baptist Church in Fort Lauderdale.
If you wonder why the President of the United States, the junior Senator of the United States, Mr. Rubio, the sitting governor of the state of Florida are fighting like you know what to stop a vote count, that ought to tell you something.
Gillum also saying on election night he was 80,000 votes behind his Republican opponent. But now,
we are now fewer than 40,000 votes behind, having picked up 50,000 votes just since election night.
Diane Magnum, CBS 4, this morning.
All right, so there you go. Andrew Gillum, I have to tell you, he is good. He may be better than Barack Obama in terms of speaking and persuasion. Laying down a marker. Andrew Gillum is really good. That doesn't mean he's honest. That doesn't mean he's good. That means he's pretty wicked good. And so the National Review had an editorial where they're demanding the firing of Brenda Snipes. And they say on Friday, a court in Broward County found that Snipes was guilty of violating both Florida's public records law and the state's constitution by failing to provide mandatory updates to the public. And it ordered the immediate release of missing information. According to the Miami Herald, an election worker found bags of uncounted early ballots in the Broward County office, ballots whose provenance could not be established. Snipes, meanwhile, was busy mixing together rejected provisional ballots and accepted provisional ballots, processing them all together. She justified her decision to add these provisional ballots to the official tally on the grounds that it would be better to include some illegal votes than to nix the legal ones with which, by her own incompetence, they have been blended. This year alone, Snipes has been reprimanded by the courts twice, once in May for illegally destroying ballots during the 2016 Democratic primary in violation of state and federal law, and again in August for illegally opening mail-in ballots in secret. How long, we wonder, does it take to establish a pattern? And I noticed, you may have noticed last night on Fox News, they kept saying there was no evidence of voter fraud. Well, there's no evidence of voter fraud. It's like every single anchor personality, maybe Sean Hannity would be the exception. I didn't listen to all of them, but I certainly heard it repeated over and over again, so much so that Molly Hemingway actually questioned it on the panel. Why do I keep hearing this? Molly, by the way, has written a great book on this. She probably will write a book. A great story published. It's called Florida Vote Scandal Coverage Shows Media Democrat Complicity Again. Meanwhile, Demand Justice, an organization founded by former members of Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign, financed by George Soros, is coming down to help count those ballots. So don't we feel better now? All right. Well, coming back, we're going to have Ken Kuklowski. We're going to talk about that new appointment, Whitaker, to the acting attorney general position. I want you to know about who he is and where that stands, because that's really heating up. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Hey, I'm Brant. So there's this guy named Jordan.
He's a healthy guy. He's a dad of six, and he works as a guide in Alaska. And he goes to the doctor, true story, he goes to the doctor, and he's diagnosed with cancer, stage four. And here's the thing. He had switched earlier from medical insurance to MediShare, where Christians share each other's medical bills. So the question for Jordan and his wife, Jenny, was, is this actually going to work?
Our medical bills exceeded $160,000. MediShare members shared all our bills.
And it was about more than just the money, too. This is a real community.
MediShare is a family, a group of people that stick with you through the hardest times of your life. I just don't know how I could have done it without MediShare.
It's so worth looking into. There's a reason this is growing so fast. So if you want to find out more, here is a number for you. 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23.
Here on American Family Radio, this is David Wolin with Haven Ministries, inviting you to anchor your day in God's Word. What would it take to make your joy complete? For some, the Chicago Cubs winning their first World Series in over 100 years seems to fit the bill, but will that joy last? And what about for the Christian? What does it take to make the joy of a Jesus follower complete? At the beginning of 1 John, it's the Apostle John who writes, "We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us. And our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ." And now get this, he writes, "We write this to make our joy complete." And in this, John reflects the heart of Jesus, whose joy it is to seek and save the lost. Get started with Anchor Devotional. Visit getanchor.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stearns with news and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
So my name is Atara. I'm a senior and my major is psychology. I love Truett. Maybe a lot of other schools out there. You can go to bigger schools. You can go to schools that's way far away from home. But in the end, one of the things that I realized is that God called me here, and that's why Truett is the perfect place for me. And if God called you here, then it's the perfect place for you also.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
French President Emmanuel Macron offended President Trump and the United States during remarks he delivered to mark the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Macron denounced nationalism, calling it a betrayal of patriotism. He warned against what he called old demons coming back to create chaos and death. Macron said the millions of soldiers who died during the Great War fought not for national pride, but to defend universal values. To attack President Trump on Armistice Day violates the basic standards of diplomatic protocol, although many of the French are not exactly known for their diplomacy. President Macron would do well to remember who pulled France's escargot out of the fire not once but twice during the 20th century. Without American nationalism and exceptionalism, the French would be wearing lederhosen and pledging allegiance to the Third Reich. I'm Todd Stearns.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Today, Republicans pushed back after Democrats formally asked the Justice Department's Ethics Office whether they have advised Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker to recuse from supervision of the special counsel investigation. Democrats, who soon take control of key House committees, allege Whitaker's past media appearances smack of anti-Mueller bias.
He should recuse himself because he has expressed total hostility to the investigation. He has said the investigation shouldn't go forward.
But counselor to the President Kellyanne Conway insisted Whitaker's past comments are old news.
If you're talking about Matt Whitaker's statements as a private citizen a year and a half ago, when the Mueller investigation first started, what he has said on cable TV, I don't think that disqualifies somebody from being the chief law enforcement officer at the Department of Justice.
The Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, whose investigators exposed the DNC Clinton campaign-funded Trump dossier and alleged surveillance of the Trump campaign, hands the gavel to ranking Democrat Adam Schiff.
We are going to find out whether he made commitments to the president about the probe, whether he has
serving as a back channel to the president or his lawyers about the probe, whether he's doing anything to interfere with the probe.
Whitaker now oversees a special counsel probe, replacing Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. House Republicans allege Rosenstein's conflicts included signing the final surveillance warrant for Trump campaign aide Carter Page to being a potential witness in an obstruction case against the president for firing FBI Director Comey.
Rod Rosenstein has an actual conflict because by definition he's a witness, and to be oversee an investigation and be a fact witness is always inappropriate, but this isn't new to have a double standard.
Late today, a Justice Department spokesperson said Whitaker is fully committed to consulting with ethics officials on his oversight role and matters that may warrant recusal on the legitimacy of his appointment. A DOJ official said Whitaker is eligible under the Federal Vacancies Reform Act.
All right, Matt Whitaker, I want to talk to you about him because we haven't had a chance yet, and this is really important stuff. So what's happening here? Oh, Catherine just sort of gave you an overview of a point that needs to be made right up front. If anyone has a conflict of interest and should have recused himself, it was Rod Rosenstein, who did not do that. Rod Rosenstein, of course, Stein is his name, Stein, is the guy that initiated the firing of Comey, wrote the memo. And that's part of Bob Mueller's investigation, the firing of Comey. So what's Rod Rosenstein, who was a character in that particular play, an actor in that particular drama, why is he overseeing the Mueller investigation? It was Rod Rosenstein who signed the warrant to surveil, illegally surveil Carter Page with a phone, using a phony dossier. What's Mueller probing? He's probing in part the FISA documentation, the Carter Page. Rod Rosenstein, his hands are all in this, and he should never have been overseeing. He should never really have appointed Mueller, but he did. So now we've got someone else, Matt Whitaker, who's going to oversee that, and Washington, at least the left part of it, is going apoplectic. What's this all about? Matt Whitaker, his crime is that he was a CNN guest several times. He wrote a paper for CNN in which he said that if the Mueller probe goes into President Trump's finances, it's a bridge too far if those finances are not connected to any link to Russia. And those are my words. I don't have his words in front of me, but that's basically what he said. So they're saying that he has to recuse himself because he said that Mueller can't go into Trump's finances. He's spoken out on this. He can't be attorney general. And then, of course, they're saying he can't be attorney general because he hasn't been vetted, or he hasn't had the advice and consent of the Senate. The statute that he was appointed under says that he has to be serving in the Justice Department 90 days, and he can serve as an appointee by the president without Senate approval for something like 230, 250 days. So it's well within the purview. Andy McCarthy's written about this. The president has every right to nominate Matt Whitaker, and his so-called conflict of interest, or the basis upon which the left wants them, is clamoring for his recusal, is like nothing. It's nothing. If you could find an attorney who has not stated an opinion on the Mueller probe, well, good luck with that one. They have to be from another country, I guess, because they all have opinions about this. So Matt Whitaker hasn't said anything that would cause him to have to recuse himself from this particular probe. And he is, by the way, refusing to step to recuse himself. I mean, we've seen that play before. Didn't we see that with Attorney General Sessions, where the whispers in his ears told him he had to recuse himself? The leftist in place at the Justice Department were quick to advise him that he must step aside. It might have been Rosenstein who recommended it. I don't know. But they did it, and out of his honor, his sense of honor, Jeff Sessions did that, and we know what's happened pursuant to that. So we have Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer. Let's see who else. Let me read the whole list here. It's Adam Schiff, Mark Warner, Dianne Feinstein, Gerald Nadler, and Elijah Cummings writing this letter demanding that Whitaker recuse himself. They say, regrettably, Mr. Whitaker's statements indicate a clear bias against the investigation that would cause a reasonable person to question his impartiality. As though Rosenstein had impartiality when he's under investigation himself. Allegedly, he should be. By Bob Mueller, if this thing were the way it ought to be. But, of course, they're buddies along with Comey. So But Rod Rosenstein's fine. They have no problem with him handling it because, of course, he doesn't have a bias. He's got his hands all over it. I mean, but of course, that makes no difference. And I want to go on here. Why are they so upset about Matt Whitaker? There was a long, there's a long post by someone I often quote who's out of the national security community. He goes by the name Sundance. He has a very long article published just yesterday in which he draws the lines about the deep state and how they have managed so far because of their control, everything going back to the Mueller investigation. The Mueller special counsel investigation has been a cover for getting actual information. Because they always, people that are subpoenaed say, well, I can't talk. I'm cooperating with the Mueller probe. And then they have to go back to the Mueller probe and get permission to interview these witnesses. It's just a happy little circle dance. And Bob Mueller has managed to keep the important information about what's really happened in the FBI and the Justice Department tapped down. And then they've also controlled the IG reports because they vet them and vet them and vet them and vet them, and they have to sign off on certain passages before the reports can be released. Plus, they have their hands all over the executive summaries. So they control the information that's been released, although it's pretty amazing that Michael Horowitz has been able to release as much damning information as he has. But trust me, it's been controlled. So Sundance's point is that Matt Whitaker is not part of this circle dance. He's not part of the team. He wasn't around. He's an outsider from Iowa. He has no obligation to protect James Comey or the current acting FBI director or the people in the Justice Department who are still embedded or Rod Rosenstein. He doesn't have to protect any of them. He's a free agent, and now he's overseeing it. And that's why they're going crazy. So he's the one that'll be overseeing the reports, overseeing the IG report. It's pretty scary for them, and that's why the fight. So now this morning, another wrinkle, and I wish I could tell you what's going to happen with this one. I can't, but here it is. The state of Maryland now has asked a federal judge for an injunction declaring this appointment of Matt Whitaker illegal. Now, let me just interject that guess who's from Maryland? Why, it's Rod Rosenstein. And my inside information has said that it's Rod Rosenstein who's stirring up this alarm about Matt Whitaker being appointed to acting AG. That's what the insiders are saying. At least one insider is saying that. So the state of Maryland is doing their part. They're asking a federal judge. The state is likely to make an unprecedented move on Tuesday in a bid to block Whitaker from exercising the duties in the position, arguing that his appointment is not legitimate. The state will claim that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein is the rightful acting attorney general, for heaven's sake. Oh, that's not in there, but for heaven's sake, that was me. The draft filing of the motion obtained by the newspaper, the New York Times, claims the president cannot, quote, bypass the constitutional and statutory requirements for appointing someone to that office. But of course he can, and if I have a chance, I'll read what Andy McCarthy says about it. There is a statute, as I just described to you. Of course he can. And so luckily for Maryland, an Obama-appointed federal judge in Maryland, Ellen Hollander, is going to be ruling on who's the legitimate acting attorney general as part of the lawsuit concerning the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, which sued Sessions in his official capacity. So after Sessions resigned from his post, the judge now must name his successor as a defendant in the litigation, essentially ruling who's in charge of the DOJ. Now, don't ask me to explain that. I can't. I'm reading from an article. We'll get attorneys on with us, and we'll find out what that actually means and if that can stick, if the judge in Maryland can actually decide who the acting attorney general is. I kind of find myself going, really? Are you kidding me? I kind of don't think so. That's just my hunch, my non-legal opinion. So who is Matt Whitaker, and why are they so upset about him? I want to give you some information about Matt. He was the executive director of the Foundation for Accountability and Civic Trust, which is a conservative watchdog that investigates fraud. And so let me give you an idea. This might help you understand why they don't like Matt Whitaker. Under his leadership, they have investigated Hillary Clinton's email scandal, potentially illegal activities by the Clinton Foundation, allegations of fraud by Soros-linked organizations, elections law violations by a group linked to left-wing megadonor Tom Steyer, campaign finance law violations by Senator Claire McCaskill, and that's not even the whole list. That's what Matt Whitaker's been doing in his leadership at the Foundation for Accountability and Civic Trust. Whitaker's a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. He was Iowa counsel for the National Rifle Association, legal counsel for the Iowa Firearms Coalition. He was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Iowa. He's very tough on crime. He prosecuted 2,500 criminals, including hundreds of illegal immigrants, drug dealers. He prosecuted leaders of a major H-1B visa immigration fraud ring. That's the skilled workers visa thing, where this has been happening now for decades, where the federal government brings in workers from, let's say, highly skilled workers in on this H-1B visa, pays them a lot less money, and fires the American workers. You may remember that, but there was a whole host of people at Disneyland who were in executive positions, a lot of IT positions, that were forced to train their replacements who came in on these H-1B visas, and then they'd lose their severance, and then they were out of a job. This was happening routinely. Now, I'm not saying Matt Whitaker was in charge of that particular investigation, but I'm reminding you what's that the scandal that surrounds the H-1B visa program. Whitaker is the first Iowan to ever lead the Justice Department. He was a starting tight end on the legendary 1990 Iowa Hawkeyes football game that made it to the Rose Bowl. He's married to his high school sweetheart, Marcy. They have three children, and I know that Matt Whitaker is a strong Christian. Matt, what else did I find out about Matt? I just have heard nothing but good things from people that know him. Andy McCarthy has written about this. He said it's conceivable that Mr. Whitaker's temporary gig as acting attorney general is an audition for the job. Then he points out that Whitaker joined the Trump Justice Department as Sessions chief of staff in October of 2017. And then he talks about the Vacancies Reform Act of 1998, the one under which the president was able to appoint him acting attorney general. And to repeat that, he's been serving for 90 days, more than 90 days. He's been there for a year. And he can serve now in this capacity for 210 days without Senate approval. So he was Attorney General John Ashcroft's chief of staff until 2004, until President Bush appointed him United States Attorney for the Southern District of Iowa. So it's reported that Leonard Leo, the Federalist Society president, Leonard is the one who has been responsible for that excellent, powerful list of judicial appointments. Leonard has a lot of sway, I should say, in the White House, has the president's ear, and it's, according to Andy here, it was Leonard who was recommending Whitaker to step in after Sessions was asked to resign. So that's kind of gives you an idea of who he is, and already Matt Whitaker has issued an interim final rule from the Department of Justice and Homeland Security that those who enter the country illegally and are captured will no longer be able to claim asylum and will instead be returned to their country of origin on an expedited basis. So he's already doing some, that might have been in the works with Sessions. I find it hard to believe that that wasn't already in the works with General Sessions, and I'm sure it was. And so Matt Whitaker, the acting, is just carrying out and finishing what Sessions was working on that issue, I'm pretty sure. And that's relevant because we see that this caravan is getting closer and closer to the border. And what are we going to do about that? I had set aside a clip for you this morning that we're not going to have time to play, but it is heart-wrenching. I believe it's ABC that did a report on another little boy who was struck with that polio-like virus. He was 5 years old, and it shows a picture. His mother tells the story. It's just hard to watch. In fact, we'll put it on our Facebook page. And he's dead now. He's dead. He lost his ability to walk. He was paralyzed from the neck down. He's struck by this virus that the CDC won't talk about. And so these parents are saying the CDC is not reporting these. They're not inspecting this. They're not doing investigations. They're not being honest with the American people. We know that this polio-like virus dates back, as far as I have read, to 2014. And that is when the first massive immigration of people from the border was allowed to take place under President Obama. I believe there's a link there. And I believe the CDC is not telling us what they should be telling us. Isn't it amazing that the left is willing for people to suffer in order to advance their political agenda? But it seems that way in California and on the border. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. The unemployment rate held at a 49-year low, while wages increased 3.1%. That is the fastest wages rate increase in nearly a decade. In the face of our currently booming economy, a remaining complaint has been the lagging wage rates. Though the economy roared, wages remained stagnant. Well, that last objection has just been shredded since the Wall Street Journal is reporting wages have now increased 3.1%. Rising tides lift all ships. Thankfully, wages are now part of that rising tide. On the financial front, it kind of feels like it's morning in America again.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. Isabella Chow is a duly elected Republican student senator at UC Berkeley. She is a strong and unwavering Christian who will not bow the knee to the Baals of political correctness. She refused to vote for a resolution to oppose President Trump's decision to define the word sex in Title IX to refer to the biological sex God has assigned to each of us at birth, either male or female. Chow's refusal brought her condemnation from her own party. But Trump's clarity in the definition will thwart the LGBT community from demanding special rights based on their sexual confusion. She said, "There's a Christian community and campus that has been praying for me and encouraging me throughout all this. If I don't represent their views, who else will? Good for her."
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
Maybe you've been hearing the messages from preborn asking listeners to join together to help save babies' lives through ultrasound, and you're not sure how to respond. Here's the story of one woman who took that step.
I heard about Mission Preborn just before December of last year and asked my husband if we could give at least $140. Just last week, we received our packet. My husband came in the house and he was telling me, "This is our preborn packet, the ultrasounds." I started crying without even seeing them. Not only were there five babies, but one of the moms was having twins. We were just elated for that.
For $140, you can sponsor five ultrasounds, and you'll receive a story and a picture of babies' lives that were spared. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your sponsorship goes to saving babies. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or go to preborn.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Turkey's president disclosed this weekend what was presumably until recently a closely held state secret. Thanks to Turkish eavesdropping inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Recep Erdogan has shared with our government and others evidence of what he claims was the liquidation there of a Saudi Islamist, Jamal Khashoggi. Erdogan's timing strongly suggests he wants this week's lame duck congressional session to advance Turkey's interests by punishing its longtime rival for leadership of Sunni Islam, the House of Saud. America's strategic interests would not be served, however, by such a one-sided response. If anything, our equities are far more closely aligned at the moment with the Saudis than with Turkey under Erdogan. We should instead punish both by imposing appropriate sanctions on those responsible for Khashoggi's murder and by designating Erdogan's jihadist proxy, the Muslim Brotherhood, as the terrorist organization it is. This is Frank Affney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. Just a personal note. My husband has been volunteering at an orphanage connected to our church, and he goes one day a week and plays with the boys. And every time he comes home, he's so moved by these little boys and how they don't have a male figure and how they cling to him, and it breaks his heart. And so that makes me realize, I confess to you that in the process of doing the work that I do, sometimes I get so caught up. I do believe it's that God has called me to do this, to deliver this to you as best I can, the news every day, through the lens of God's word as best I possibly can. Nevertheless, as a Christian, that's a limiting, that's not very life-giving sometimes. And I think that we must maintain balance, which means we need to reach out and help people. And that has nothing to do, I'm speaking to myself, but a lot of you that listen to me, you're involved with you take in the news all the time. If you listen to me every day, you do. And so I'm just saying, let's not neglect now our duty to help people. And this Christmas is a good time to do that. I've been telling you about these Operation Christmas Child, which are these boxes, you know, that a lot of you get them at church. That's where we got ours. But you get a book, a box that looks like a shoebox, and you pack it with stuff for a boy or a girl. And the boxes are collected coming up next week, actually, at lots of locations around the country. And let me just say before I introduce my guest that you can find out more about this at SamaritansPurse.org/occ.org. Samaritans. Now, wait a second. That can't be right. Hey, Randy, help me. What's the actual?
Good morning.
Let's just start with correcting me. That wasn't the right address. What is it exactly?
Let's keep it as simple as possible. SamaritansPurse.org.
Okay. All right, thank you. I can do that. I know I can do that. Oh, let me just say that Randy Riddle is the Senior Director of Operations Director of Operation Christmas Child. Randy, so glad to have you join us this morning. And I want to know, first of all, you've been with him for 20 years, so you know this whole process well. I want to know, whose idea was this anyway?
Well, of course, many of your listeners already support what we do, and let me just lead with a thank you. Our president is Franklin Graham. He's the son of Dr. Billy Graham, of course, and Samaritan's Purse has been operating this program called Operation Christmas Child for 25 years. The idea actually came from a couple of radio personalities in the UK who learned about some orphans that year. It's great to hear about your heart for orphans, you and your husband, Sandy. And these two guys in the UK heard about the plight of some orphans in Eastern Europe, and they started asking their listening audience for simple gifts for children living in an orphanage. They received a few thousand gifts that first year and called Mr. Graham, our president, and said, "Hey, would you consider getting involved?" And of course, Mr. Graham said yes, happy to do so. That fall, he called a few of his pastor friends across the United States, and that first year collected 18,000 of these simple shoebox gifts, and that started what we believe now is a movement. We of course now send these shoebox gifts to the tune of 12 million each year, somewhere around that every year, to the neediest children living in the world in more than 100 countries. And so began with two radio personalities.
Well, good for them. It makes me proud of my kind. Okay, so you've been with them for 20 years, Randy, and obviously you've invested a tremendous part of your life in this. And even though you weren't there at the beginnings, and you were there at the early part where it wasn't where it is now. So my question to you is, you know, I believe you would probably agree with me that God calls us to do these things, that God called you to be in that position. So when was that moment when you actually felt that affirmation? You saw something happen in the process of Operation Christmas Child that said to you, "Now I know why you want me here, Lord," or "Now I see your hand in this." Was there some point when that happened?
Sandy, I was so thankful to hear a little bit of your earlier show as I was waiting to speak with you this morning. My story is similar to your husband's. I joined Samaritan's Purse 23 years ago and thought this was a really neat opportunity to be a part of something good. And then God allowed me to visit orphanages in Romania, and it was on the floor of an orphanage in Romania that God really broke my heart for what he was doing for his children. through these simple gifts that are used as a platform for the gospel. Of course, these gifts will perish. These gifts will be lost or broken or fall apart over time, just like any of our physical gifts that we receive throughout the years. But the Word of God stands forever. And so we have this privilege of delivering, with every shoebox gift, a message of God's love, His gospel. So every child now that receives a shoebox gift hears about the love of God, typically in a verbal proclamation of the gospel that will be followed up with, and this is a non-manipulative way. We're not making shoebox Christians. We're just presenting the reason why we're celebrating Christmas, which is the birth of Jesus. And so then every shoebox gift is handed out with literature that is written in the child's language, and sometimes even decorated in the child's culture. And following that, for 5 million of our children, we're growing this program, but for 5 million of those 12 million, we offer the opportunity for discipleship. So the proclamation of the gospel really is why and how we believe God has fueled this program forward over the past 25 years.
Well, let's get practical, because sometimes this is kind of hard to get your hands around, because a lot of churches actually have these shoeboxes. Mine does. But I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure not every church does. So if people are hearing this and they don't exactly know really where to go and how to start this, so how could they do this?
Pretty simple. This week is National Collection Week, so our call is very timely. Go to Samaritan's Purse. It's just like the Good Samaritan, samaritanspurse.org. You can find out everything you need to pack a shoebox and where to deliver it. We have more than 5,000 drop-off locations opened this week through next Monday, opening their doors to the local public. Typically, local churches are collecting on our behalf. So we're looking for the very simplest of items. You can find a shoebox in the back of your closet. We would ask you to choose for a boy or a girl, and choose the age category that you'd like to give to, 2 to 4, 5 to 9, or 10 to 14, and then go buy items specific to that that age and gender. So my children are all teens or preteens, so we like to go for the older categories, 11 to 14, and we find school supplies, hygiene items. We find articles of clothing, what we call a wow item, which is just a toy, maybe a soccer ball or a baby doll for a girl. The simplest of items. These are not expensive gifts, but they're very profound gifts. If you're living in an orphanage somewhere, or you're living in a third world somewhere, you've never received a gift before, wow, what an impression that makes. And so the children that we reach are looking for the very simplest of gifts. Even a washcloth is very well-received, a toothbrush, very well-received. So we're looking for the simplest of items to be packed in a shoebox gift and delivered to your local drop-off location this week.
You know, that reminds me of something funny. I remember when I was in Russia many years ago, and this was before the Soviet Union broke up, and the thing they told us to put in our suitcase as much as we could to give away was nylons. Hosiery, that's what women wanted. You think, you know, they'd want like a spangle, a bracelet. No, put in pantyhose. And so, I mean, so the point is that people, there are things that they find very special and unique that we take for granted. And that's the kind of thing that can be added to. They don't need fancy things sometimes. They just need simple things. Randy, you know, sometimes it could be said that programs can be a feel-good thing for the people on this end. In Western civilization, we have so much, and this is a way of making people feel better about themselves because they're doing something. But what evidence do you have that on the other end it actually impacts these children?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you. In terms of God's spiritual economy, I think that's what we have to look at for sure. And 80% of people who come to know Jesus do so between the ages of 4 and 14. And so there's no, there's definitely purpose behind why we're reaching out to children. The children are most open to receive Jesus. And so, yes, this makes us feel good to celebrate the birth of Jesus by giving a gift, for sure. But on the far end, the meaning here is the opportunity to come to know Jesus. And through our discipleship program, in a moderate, in a very conservative estimation with real numbers to back up, we estimate every 20 seconds throughout the year, a child is committing their life to Jesus Christ through our discipleship program. So that's the eternal difference this program is making. That's the eternal difference as we proclaim the gospel before 12 million children and their families, and we seek to disciple 5 million children every year. God is using this program to draw children and the men and women who surround them into his kingdom. And so that's the purpose. If we feel good doing it, that's great, but the end result is not a happy child. The end result is the opportunity for eternal life by coming to know Jesus Christ, God's one and only Son.
Yeah, and abundant life in this life. SamaritansPurse.org, SamaritansPurse.org. Randy, there's also a way to sort of track your package, right, and kind of maybe even set up a correspondence with you and the child?
Well, absolutely. We are first would say we're not UPS, but if you are giving a shoebox this year, we do ask for a $9 contribution for each shoebox. And if you choose to do that online through SamaritansPurse.org, you choose to follow your box option. And so let's say, Sandy, you pack your shoebox gift and you give your $9 contribution online through the Follow Your Box program. We'll send a report back to your family as to which country your shoebox traveled. And so you'll get an email that will tell you where your shoebox traveled to, a little bit of information about the children who live in that area. And, of course, we encourage our donors to write a letter, write a note to the child to include your address. And many times pen pal relationships have begun.
Any stories about those? I know you've probably got so much information that maybe a simple story escapes you because you know there are so many. But if you have one, it would be great.
You know, I would tell you about my friend now, Julia, who lives inside the United States, grew up in the former Soviet Union, and received a shoebox gift, the first gift she'd ever received before. And this was when she received her gift was 12 years ago. Inside that gift was a stuffed puppy dog made by the Beanie Baby Company, the Beanie Baby people. A donor had placed a stuffed animal, a puppy dog, inside her box. And also inside that box was a letter from a child living in North Carolina. This little girl, Yulia, never let go of that puppy dog and found her way to the United States, found her way actually on scholarship to Liberty University, and then discovered students on her campus packing shoebox gifts. And from that, she learned more about Operation Christmas Child, contacted us, and showed us that she had developed a pen pal relationship with her donor, with this young lady living in North Carolina. And she kept every letter. She kept the puppy dog. She kept the now empty shoebox plastic gift that she received. And they're lifelong friends to this day.
Wow,
so
Randy.
This letter, this shoebox became an encouragement throughout her lifetime.
Well, and she came to Liberty, so there's some spiritual awakening there, too. Whether she had it before she got the box, we don't know. But that's a great story, Randy. Randy Riddle is the director of Operation Christmas Child. And by the way, if you haven't yet gotten your shoebox together, it's SamaritansPurse.org for all the information. This is drop-off week, so hurry. SamaritansPurse.org. Randy, God bless you and the Ministry of Samaritan's Purse and Operation Christmas Child. And it's very nice to meet you through the radio.
Nice to meet you, Sandy. Yeah. God bless you.
Yes, thank you so much. All right, Sandy Rios, back again in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.